Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Mark Prendergast. Mark is the author of The Ambient Century, From Mahler to Trance, The Evolution of Sound in the Electronic Age, and he's coming out with a new volume of this encyclopedic review of ambient and techno music very shortly. Mark, when is that coming out?
It's coming out in the UK in August the 3rd.
And you have any idea about a U.S.
release? In September, but no date yet.
No date.
It's so fully revised.
6 months later, probably in the States.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because of the encyclopedic nature of the volume, there were three editors involved, and the actual book that was published wasn't actually the book I wrote originally, and in part. So I've taken it upon myself over 2 months to revise it back to what it should be, because a lot of American academics picked up on certain errors which I wasn't aware of in the book, current edition.
You've been writing about music for quite a while. Now, have you always specialized in techno-ambient?
No. I started writing when I was in Ireland. I was born in Dublin. I attended Trinity College Dublin, studying economics. My background said you should get a job in a bank, but ended up working in a record shop, a brilliant record shop. And so at the time, there was an awful lot of new music coming out, and I heard it all. And also the guy who was the manager, he had an encyclopedic knowledge of the 60s, so I learned all about that. And it was from that, and my knowledge, that the Irish Times approached me and said, do you want to be a music critic? So I was in university in Dublin, and the Irish Times came and said, can you be a music critic? And that's how it started, writing about music. I was 20 at the time.
Now, this book is about the history of ambient music. What exactly qualifies something to be ambient? Because you start all the way with late 19th century composers, and you bring it up to contemporary music that is commonly referred to as ambient. So is it anything that's avant-garde or experimental, or is there a particular kind of music that has to be ambient?
The first misconception of this book is that it's a history of ambient music. It's not a history of ambient music. It's a history of sound. It says, from Mahler, now it's called From Mahler to Moby, The Evolution of Sound in the Electronic Age. That's what the book's about.
So it's about the influence of electronica?
No, it's about the evolution of sound itself, the sound in music. Because as you have to understand this. If you go back to Satie or Debussy or those people were the first musicians to be living in the electronic age. Debussy was one of the very first people to have his music recorded. It was recorded on a player piano, on piano rolls. And the whole idea of recording and everything starts then. But because of recording and because of technology, the whole idea of sound in music, of ambient sound, became the dominant force in the evolution of sound. That's why it's called the ambient century. But it's not a history of ambient music per se. It's a history of sound. It's also a history of modern music and also a history of 20th century music.
But you focus on composers whose music is creates a kind of, you know, is not doesn't have lyrics, right? Often doesn't have lyrics.
Yes. I think the idea of creating space in music and space, as Brian Eno said so famously, it encourages space to think. I mean, the great thing about the electronic age is that you could record sound in such a way that you had space between it, and that space allows you to get into the music more. If you take a Bruckner symphony, I mean, it's so full of instruments and so intense and so you know, combined, that it's very hard to listen to over a long period of time. But I think the whole idea of space and sound, of electronic instruments and the studio and all of that, and the new types of writing in music, allowed for more space and allowed for more the creation of space, which I call ambient.
As I said, your volume, as you said, the volume is encyclopedic, and we can't go through a fraction of it. But you have a top 10 list of your favorite ambient pieces and albums. And so I thought
that the top 10 list is just it's to recommend to people who don't know anything a quick way of getting in. In the book itself, there's 100 records that define the 20th century.
Right.
So the 100 records start off with Mahler and they end with Air. Of course, now it ends with Moby.
So what I've done is we're going to structure this interview around your top 10 list, and I've picked out this first piece that we're going to listen to briefly and then discuss, is this Satie's Nocillons. Is that how you say it?
Nocillons, yeah.
One of the things I discovered when I started listening to Satie was that music was very familiar. It's been used as atmospheric music for a lot of films an awful lot of things.
Yeah.
Now, tell us a little bit about Satie. He was one of the first of your composers.
Yes, Erik Satie is absolutely crucial to the 20th century. The reason being he was an anarchist and a rebel. And he was born in Honfleur in 1806. And he was a very strange character because he was thrown out of the Paris Conservatoire for laziness, of all things. Now, Debussy and Ravel and all those composers, they really, really liked him because he had kind of completely original take on music. I mean, the Nocillons you're listening to now is based on a trip to the Paris Exposition of the early 20th century, and there he saw a lot of and heard a lot of Oriental and Eastern music. So the Nocillons is based on the concept, on the non-Western concept of no time signature, and also there are no bar lines in that piece. So it really opens the music out to a very, it's a very different kind of concept to Western classical music. And the only person I think that can play the Nocillons and the Sarabande and the Gymnopédie the way they were written is Reinbert Deloux, the Belgian pianist, and his 1977 recording is absolutely essential for anybody.
Now, Mahler, Satie, Debussy, Ravel, these are all pre-World War II composers. And then after World War II, there's a renaissance of people using electronic instruments and a much more radical avant-garde approach to music. And some of those names you mention are Varese.
Varese.
Cage, Stockhausen, and Boulez. And although Stockhausen wasn't on your top 10 list, I've heard a lot about Stockhausen, and I think people may be more familiar with Cage, or at least with his 4 minutes of silence and things like that, because of being an American audience, but Stockhausen was German. I have just a brief piece of Stockhausen piano sonata here from the 80s from an album called Mantra. But I had originally found this piece, Four Helicopters. That is just Four Helicopters.
The Helicopter String Quartet from Wednesday, Wednesday, Mittwoch Wednesday, from his ginormous opera cycle, Light or Lick, which he started writing in 1977 and is still working on it.
Oh, really?
It was supposed to be finished by the new millennium and conducted in 7 different cities for each day. But that didn't happen, and so he's not finished it yet. But he wanted to outdo Wagner. He wanted to write an opera that was larger. But I think 7 days is a very long opera.
Actually, this what we're listening to now, this is Mantra. I found this in our record library.
Stockhausen is probably the most important composer of electronic music in the history of the genre. The reason being because he invented electronic music. He wrote electronic music before anyone else did. And he used like tone generators and very basic stuff in the studios in Paris and Cologne and in the 1940s. And he was really, really, he had to make, say, 6 months to make a very short piece using tape and electronic tone generators. But he had this absolute vision of electronic music as being the music of the future.
He mixes a lot of different kind of genres. He has pianos and electronics and ambient sound, and I understand that he used to drop things into pianos.
Yes, well, all that stuff came later, but his importance in this book is the invention of electronic music, and his influence on everybody, including the Beatles and probably everybody that took up electronics after him.
Now, in your book, you have a section on the 60s where you talk about people like Jimi Hendrix and Country Joe and the Fish, and people who, largely because of psychedelic drugs, were influenced to have long instrumental passages that were trance-like or ambient. Is that the significance of that period, that kind of psychedelia?
Well, the significance of the 60s is many things. So first of all, it's the increase in disposable income of young people, so there was a market for the teenager. The second thing is the fact that, you know, multi-track recording started to develop, and it's developed in a crucial way. Multi-track recording allowed for more information on a record, etc. Studios started to get more sophisticated, and you couple, say, psychedelic drugs like marijuana or LSD, and you couple that with very, very conservative middle-class white musicians, and black, some of them, and you get this sort of amazing experimental period, which produced incredible music.
I'm speaking with Mark Prendergast. He's the author of The Ambient Century, From Mahler to Trance, The Evolution of Sound in the Electronic Age. And he's speaking to me from London. We're talking about his top 10 list for an introduction to ambient music. When we get past this 1950s stage...
Year zero was 1950. That's what Boulez and Stockhausen and Massillon, who's very important to history music as well, because of his writing and changing the whole way we write music, called year zero, 1950, when music could start all over again. Just a point about Stockhausen. Stockhausen is a total serialist. Now, serial music invented by Schoenberg is using 12 tones in a 12-tone row and is very stringent mathematically. But Stockhausen went further. He said that everything should be annotated, every single thing, pitch, length, duration, everything. So his music is very complex and sounds very strange. So that's what serialism is. And so in 1950, they called it the year zero, when music could literally start all over again.
Now, define for us the minimalists. There are people you mentioned, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, Brian Eno. They're still around.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And they started mostly in the 70s. And we're going to listen to a piece by Brian Eno, Music for Airports.
Oh, yeah.
Actually going on in this piece, is this a vocal choir modulated electronically, or?
This was composed in 1978, Music for Airports. Remember, Brian Eno had invented the actual definition of ambient music in 1975 with discrete music, but he had spent a lot of time in America, and he was very interested in the idea of music that wasn't Muzak, that was calm, induced the space to think, and as ignorable as interesting, as he says in the back of the record, where he actually outlines his manifesto for ambient music. Now, music for airports includes contributions from Robert Wyatt, who plays piano on the first track, and who was in the Soft Machine in the UK, and Connie Plank, the very famous producer of German krautrock bands like Neu. Now, what he has done here is he's taken various tape loops of sound, some of them very long, 80 feet long, would you believe, and he had 6 tape loops, and he cut them into different lengths, and he put them on 4 different tape machines, and using a graphic equalizer allowed them to overlap over time. And it's a very interesting thing, because he's using single notes and harmonized voices, and track 3 is a mix of track 1 and 2, so it was very easy for him to do, but it's a very effective ambient record.
So actually, he just created this tracking by having these multiple tapes of different lengths running at the same time. Wow, that's
he
amazing.
Still works like that in installations. All his installations is all over the world. Used CD changers.
So it was as much an art piece as a music piece.
Yes. But he had great ability to be able to make it and make it accessible to the public.
No, we mentioned
beautiful piece, though. Robert Wyatt's piano playing is fantastic. Which track is this?
This is track 2, I think.
2-1, yes. This is the harmonized voices.
Right.
Single note. Only single notes. As he had very well described by Eric Tam. Do you know Eric Tam?
No.
The writer. He's written the dissertations on both Brian Eno and Robert Fripp. But his book, which was published by Faber many years ago, is called Brian Eno and the Vertical Color of Sound, which is a very amazing idea, this idea of vertical building of notes, one on top of the other, to go to this kind of ambience. It's amazing.
I skipped ahead a second ago when I started talking about the 60s. Now, I guess I've got these...
Minimalism. He wants to go into minimalism. Very important for Eno. Do you want me to talk about it?
Sure, let's talk about minimalism.
Yeah.
Now,
minimal
Glass
music,
comes out of this
Hello?
Philip Glass comes out of this.
Yes. Minimalist music, which was like invented by people like Lamont Young, who was involved with the Velvet Underground, and Philip Glass, and Steve Reich, and Terry Riley, of course, very important. It's a music that's not based on the Western system, the Western scales, or the way that Western music is organized. It's based on Eastern music. All of these people traveled a lot in different cultures, from Philip Glass to Afghanistan, Iraq, everywhere, India, Terry Riley, obviously India, Steve Reich to Africa, because his music is drum-based. And their concept of music was based on non-Western music. When Philip Glass was in Paris in 1966, he was doing some work for Ravi Shankar, who told him there's no bar lines in our music, and he then decided to write music idiomatically like Indian music. And it was Philip Glass performing in London during the 70s, and David Bowie and Eno saw the concert in London and decided that this is the future. And it's that influence, minimalism, on Eno, who was always a minimalist fan, that it produced this sound of music for airport.
I want to move on to the middle 70s with Pink Floyd, which...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because you mentioned Wish You Were Here. And this is when I was a teenager and, you know, using my own psychedelic experiences for musical enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
And Pink Floyd was definitely one of those.
Well, Pink Floyd are very important in the history of music as well.
Right. Now, let me put on Wish You Were Here. It's probably familiar to a lot of people in the audience.
Over Here followed on the heels of Dark Side of the Moon, which is the defining moment of Pink Floyd. And it's not that well known, but they spent 16 months, more or less, working on around Dark Side of the Moon, from the creation to the actual end of mixing. And then they were touring a lot, and they were very... by the time they come back to London after touring and everything on Dark Side, they said they were burnt out. And it was the first 7 months of 1975 they recorded Wish You Were Here. And the actual album is basically a summation of Pink Floyd, their life, Sid Barrett, his burnout, and the fact that they were very alienated. Wish You Were Here is about that alienation. But the great thing about the Floyd is that they were very open to experiment, and they used equipment in a very good way. And they used multi-track recording and EMI and everything, and their whole concept of music was based on space, yes.
Now, I'm speaking with Mark Prendergast. He's the author of The Ambient Century, From Mahler to Trance, The Evolution of Sound in the Electronic Age, and his new volume coming out, which will be an update of this encyclopedic volume.
Yeah, it's called From Mahler to Moby.
Mahler to Moby.
That's what the book will be called now.
Now, we're working through...
Shall we correct that? Because people will be looking for the wrong book.
Yes, Mahler to Moby.
From Mahler to Moby.
Look for that one. But so Ambient Century will get you there also.
Yeah.
Now, we're working through your top 10 list of an introduction to ambient music, and the rest of the top 10 list is our works from the 80s and 90s. And Daruti Kalam is what we have queued up next. And we're going to listen to a little bit of Otis from Daruti Kalam.
Okay, then.
They introduced there at the beginning of this song a sampled vocal element, which is very kind of reminiscent of something that Moby becomes famous for later.
Yes.
Well, what's the significance of Daruti Kalam in the evolution of sound?
Well, Vinnie Reilly, who's the guitarist and is Daruti Kalam, is a very unusual type of musician in the fact that he's associated on the one hand with Factory Records in Manchester, which was the home of Joy Division and New Order, who are probably much more well-known in America. And actually, Factory Records was founded by Tony Wilson for Vinnie. But Vinnie was a very ill guy at the time, very frail. And Tony Wilson, who was presented a TV program on Granada in Manchester, wanted to support him. So his first album, The Return of Daruti Kalam, in 1980, was a sandpapered sleeve, it's an almost classical record. And the reason for this was his father was into Benjamin Britten and opera, and his mother was into classical music, and they were also into Fats Waller and Art Tatum, so his background was very musical. And at the age of 10, he started studying classical music, Bach and Martinu and stuff. But then, in 1977, he was in a punk band called the Nosebleeds. And so, I mean, it's basically the influence of classical and jazz is coming through a minimalist guitar player who started off in punk. So it's a very different kind of music. And this album, Vinnie Reilly, 1989, is based around sampled voices. Joan Sutherland is there, and Annie Lennox, and of course Otis Redding, which is a track you've played.
Now, I think one of the first ambient pieces I ever heard when I was about 13 was Vangelis's Vangelis.
Yes.
Vangelis's Albedo 369 or whatever it is. Yeah. And someone had this album, and I remember it stuck in my mind quite vividly. But he went on to do a lot of soundtrack music for film. Yeah. And in particular, we're going to listen to next the Blade Runner soundtrack.
Oh, which, very important.
Yes.
He was a very strange character. Vangelis, his full name is Papathanasio, is Greek, obviously. And his name means message from God. Vangelis actually means that. And he had, during the time in the 70s, early 70s, there was a military government in Greece, and so he himself and Demis Roussos set up camp in Paris, where they recorded as Aphrodite's Child, of all things. In 1974, he was invited to London by Yes to rehearse his keyboard player, but he didn't like the setup, so he built his own 1,500-square-foot studio. Now, at the time, in the late 70s, he was also interested in polyphonic synthesizers, and so he had a Yamaha CS-80 imported from Japan, and that's what defines the sound on Blade Runner soundtrack. Now, in this studio in Marble Arch, London, he had a quadraphonic mixer and 24-track, and he was doing a lot of film music, and all he did was play the film and just play along to it. So, but Blade Runner is the one that really stands out in his canon. The actual title of the film actually comes from William Burroughs, your great writer. But he plays Prophet synthesizers on this, and he also uses early drum machines, and hence the soundtrack. It was very influential on Detroit techno and people like Tricky, and also the Future Sound of London. But amazingly enough, the actual album wasn't released until 1994. So the soundtrack itself in the film was the one that influenced all these musicians. But there have been 25 bootleg versions, so there you go.
This has been the first half of an interview with Mark Prendergast about The Ambient Century, From Mahler to Trance, and the new version, From Mahler to Moby, his encyclopedic review. Look up the second half on changesurfer.com or check back next week where you can hear it here. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.